Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Andrew. How are you? I'm so sorry. You must be thinking I'm a really damn blonde.
No.
I'm really trying to get used to all this now.
Uh-huh.
I really appreciate my listeners for waiting for me because, I knew this is going to be, my first show, and it's going to be a lot of hiccups and all this and that. Anyway, I'm so pleased that you accepted my invitation to come on Orion Talk Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard you before, but can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and how you actually got into, debunking the 9/11, what happened on 9/11?
Sure, certainly, yes. I really got into, this whole business, I suppose, in 2003. My background about myself, my background is actually in computer programming, or really software engineering, which is a little bit more than computer programming. I did that for quite a number of years, ended up getting involved in some tutoring and education in that area, and I now work part-time for an organization called the Open University in England, and they deliver correspondence courses primarily. And I tutor part-time for them on a computing course. That's the connection with my days of doing the software engineering. And I also see disabled students with disabilities, to try and assess them for access to special equipment and such for when they're doing their higher education courses. From the engineering perspective, I've got a background in analysis, and one of the things you have to do with a computer program is you tend to have to absorb quite a lot of information and then process it and come up with some results, which you can then act on in some way. And really, it was in 2003 that I began to sort of get interested in the UFO question, actually, around that time initially, and I'd got a broadband internet connection for the first time. It had just become available in my area, at a reasonable price, and so I started sort of downloading things, and downloading videos and audios and documents and things like this. And at one time I downloaded a film called 9/11 The Great Illusion, which was by a Texan called George Humphrey. And I thought, well, that's an interesting film, that's an interesting title. What does it mean, it's an illusion? I saw 9/11, it certainly wasn't an illusion, it really did happen and everything. And so I watched that, and within that film, essentially, there was a segment of 4 or 5 minutes in length, and it showed how the towers sort of came down at free fall speed. And so I looked at that, and basically I realized that I could check what was said in the film quite easily, because if you look at the equations of motion, you can determine how long it will take something to fall down, so I looked up how tall the towers were, and I looked up basically worked out the figure that it would take if you dropped a ball bearing from the top of the towers, down to the ground. You come out with a figure of around about 9 seconds, and and so the towers came down. Well, actually, we'll get to that later, maybe. But they didn't come down. They actually turned to dust. But they disappeared in about that time, in about 9 seconds approximately. And so I realised that that moment, in seeing this film, which I think was probably mid-2004, so that's going back 7 years now, really, that the official story, there's no chance of it being true. There was something else going on that day which we haven't been told about. And so I then started to investigate, the stuff that was already posted on the internet. A lot of people were, ahead of me. Obviously, I'd believed the official story for almost 3 years from the day itself, so I wasn't particularly, quick off the mark or anything. There were other people that I know who knew as soon as it happened that something very strange went on, and they knew the official story wasn't true. They knew it was false, and so I sort of went forward from there, really, and and then I.
Sorry, Andrew, can I just stop you? We're going into a break.
Okay.
But it's quite amazing to me because, I mean, I'm a layman's person, you know, and the first thing I always saw was the buildings just came down, and yes, the planes did it until I looked further into it. Mm. And I still do not understand really sometimes how this all could happen.
Right.
But we are going now into a break, so stay with me, and this is going to be very interesting for me as well because I'm going to learn something really new again. Thank you. Right, Andrew, we are back now on air. I'm sorry, I'm still have to learn, you know, we actually can talk off air, but I don't know still how to do this. But I would like you to have the floor, actually, because I'm just totally intrigued about your evidence and about how you come into your conclusion. So you have the floor, young man.
Oh, okay. Thanks very much. Yeah, I mean, people can go and look at my website as well. It's checktheevidence.com, and I've got pretty much everything posted on there, and there's a lot there as well. But basically, going back to, you know, how I got into this, I'd seen this film and the towers, you know, were destroyed in a certain way and they came down at free fall speed. And so then I knew that there was something we weren't being told. So I kind of, started writing letters at that point. I wrote to my MP, Member of Parliament, you know, it's a political representative in the UK, that's what we call them. And, didn't really get much out of them, not that I expected to, you know, and I'd read about, things like false flag terrorism and state-sponsored terrorism, and I really started to get into it and uncover all that stuff. And I suppose, you know, for about a year, I was sort of communicating with a few people, and I got in touch with a couple of people in London after about 6 months. So that was probably early 2005, and. Then the UK, a few people in the UK started this internet forum, which is still going actually, and they were posting stuff about 9/11 and the latest research that was being put out, you know, and so I got involved with setting up that forum because of my background in programming. There was a little tiny bit of programming involved in that, and I sort of fiddled with that and helped set that up with it. I didn't do much of the work. Somebody else did most of it, but I helped out a bit. And, we ended up getting about, I don't know, 400 or 500 members on that forum fairly, you know, within a few weeks, I think, something like that. And, I just really went forward with that. And, I suppose the next phase really was I started posting this thing about the free fall. This, you know, I calculated the free fall time using the equations of motion, which is a little thing you can do with the, you know, it's a basic equation from that you learn in your physics class. And I posted that on a physics forum, and because, you know, special interest forums, as you know, around the internet, one of them, there's a very popular physics one, and I just sort of said, oh, well, I'll join up with this physics forum and see if anybody can pick any holes in this, because to me it looks, you know, it looks pretty clear cut, really. I can't really see anything wrong with it. So I'm keen to know if I'm missing something obvious, you know. And so I posted it on there, and I don't know when that was, probably, I don't know, August 2005, something like that. I'd have to go back and check, because that thread is still there, this forum thread is still all there. And anyway, this thing, it ran and ran, you know, and boy, did it get some traffic onto this thread. I think there were ended up with about, I don't know, about 2,000 responses or something ridiculous. It was like loads of stuff posted on there. So I thought, wow, you know, people are really going at this, you know. And I think, you know, I'd made some fairly sort of cogent arguments, and nobody really seemed to be able to sort of take them apart, other than just to be rude, you know. And that's when people are just rude to you, as you know, they can't really sort of say, oh, well, this is where you made your mistake, you know, you got the wrong figure here, or you've forgotten about this factor here that you need to put in. No one really said anything like that. So you know, and there are other people that said the same as I did about the free fall. I'm not trying to say I was sort of pioneering in any way. I wasn't, you know. I just sort of put it in a slightly different way to what other people had, you know. You know, I mean, I don't think I've come up with anything particularly new, really. There's a couple of things I did later which were sort of more original, which I can mention later. But basically, what then happened was, I got invited to join the scholars group because partly why I went to the trouble of introducing my connection to this, you know, this Open University. And because I was involved with the Open University partly, and because I'd put this physics challenge thing up, I got invited to join this group which had started up, but it was an internet group. It wasn't like a formal group. It's called Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Right. And I was invited by this character called Stephen E. Jones, and he sent me an email saying, "Oh, we'd like to invite you to Scholars for 9/11 Truth because we're a group of academics getting together, you know, and we're going to try and sort of make some waves, you know." And I thought, "Oh, great, you know, this is really good," because I'd been at this for over a year, really, you know, and I was thinking that nobody was really bothered, you know, nobody cared particularly.
Right.
Certainly not in the academic community. There'd been no signs of that, really, that I'd seen. So when this Scholars for 9/11 Truth, I thought, oh, great, somebody's picking up on this, you know. And the other person that was involved was a chap called Jim Fetzer. And I'd already come across him because, you know, I don't know how, I think some of the listeners on this network will be familiar with shows like Coast to Coast and, and Rents.com and, you know, Jeff Rents and all these. And Jim Fetzer, I know, had been on these programs already, and he talked about the JFK assassination. So it seemed sort of fairly natural for him to get involved with the 9/11 issues, you know, that were coming up. And so it's he and Stephen E. Jones that formed the Scholars Group. And anyway, so I joined that, and, you know, they listed me on their website and put my, you know, qualifications. I've got a degree in computer science and physics, you know. And but they invited me as a full member, and they had this sort of tiered membership. And they said that if you were a tenured professor, in other words, if you had a permanent job at a university, you know, full time, and you were doing research and, you know, taking full lectures and that, that you could join as a full member. But they invited me as a full member, but they shouldn't have done that, really, because I wasn't a professor. I never have been, you know, probably never will be. So that was a bit odd. But anyway, I didn't really think much about that. And so what the next thing that really happened is Steve Jones had published this paper about thermite, and he was asking people to review it. And you may have heard the buzz on the internet, possibly. This is what most people have heard of, that if you don't believe that Al-Qaeda destroyed the towers, then, you know, a lot of people believe that thermite was used. And
I heard that.
Yeah, and this was really put forward in 2005. And the curious thing is, when you look at it and you take a step back, is that just before the Scholars Group was formed, NIST, which is the National Institute for Standards and Technology, they'd published 10,000 pages of technical reports supposedly explaining how the buildings were destroyed. Now, of course, this was a second kind of formal report. We had the 9/11 Commission report, the Keene report, so-called Keene report, which I think was published in 2003. I don't know the date. And then that was just like a general sort of, we don't know what happened, but we know Al-Qaeda did it report. You know, we don't know exactly how they did it, but we know they did it. And it was a 571-page report, but the NIST reports obviously ran to 10,000 pages. And it was just after this that this Steve Jones character came on the scene. And then he came out with this thermite explanation. I think he was trying to base a lot of it supposedly on what was shown in these technical reports, you know, that NIST had produced. And they were paid, NIST were given $16 million, I think it was either $13 million or $16 million by Congress. They had a mandate by Congress to produce these reports, you know. And so anyway, I thought, oh yeah, this Jones, Stephen E. Jones, he's come out. He's a physicist at Brigham Young. He's you know, he's got a job there. He must know what he's doing. You know, he must be an honest guy, basically, is what I thought. And he says that thermite was involved, you know, and so I believed him. And, you know, he made this little presentation about an hour long or an hour and a half, and I made that into it was posted online, you know, and I downloaded it and made it into a DVD, you know, and I gave these DVDs out to people, and I think I might have sent a copy to my local MP saying, you know, this is a physics professor. He said that it wasn't Al-Qaeda, you know, you better listen to him and all this.
And here we...
coming up for
another.
That's all right.
Yeah, we're coming up for another break. Get yourself a cup of coffee or a glass of wine or whatever you drink. And we will be back. Actually, the show starts again in about 1:33. So you can, you know, relax and stretch your bones. Okay? I'm really interested in this.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's right. Well, there's quite a lot to the stories, I think, because I think we spoke briefly before, didn't we?
Yes, we did. So just go and stretch your legs.
Okay. Yeah, I'm okay now. I've got my water and I'm just needed a drink. So I've been actually building a bed for my son today, because we've got my son's room around. So I've been shifting things around.
And here we are again, and I'm pleased to tell you all, Andrew Johnson is still with me, so I haven't bored him to death yet, and I'm really, really excited, because I really want to learn a lot, and I'm glad he can stay with my show for 2 hours, so we can get through everything, really. So, Andrew, I'm going to let you have the floor, and thank you for holding my hand.
Yeah, not at all. Absolutely. Well, thanks for inviting me on. I always try and just use these opportunities to tell people things that they might not be aware of, which I think are important. So, I think the history is important in understanding things. That's why I'm trying to give a little bit of time on that and show you how my understanding has changed in this. And basically, you know, this scholars group had formed, as I was saying, and I then supported the Stephen Jones character, and with this theory about the thermite, and he did this presentation and he showed this video of this yellowish material coming from one of the towers just before the towers actually came down. And this, you know, it was like, it really did look like a molten metal. And this was one of the things that was talked about a lot in this scholars group, was that the towers couldn't have been taken down by the planes because the jet fuel wasn't hot enough, you know, to turn the metal into a molten, you know, state, which is true, you know, because the jet fuel will burn, I think it's 600 degrees Celsius or something, and the steel won't melt until 1500, so it's not just, you know, it's like a factor of 2.5 difference, you know. And so this was what I went round repeating. No, it can't have been the planes, you know, because there was just molten metal, and we know that kerosene could have melted the steel and blah, blah, and I went round repeating all that stuff. And then we go forward about another year, really, because I then noticed that this there was a kind of a split developing in the scholars group, and it was that basically what was happening was that there was some other research was coming into the picture, and it was saying that this molten metal was questionable. And also, that I think the first thing I became aware of is that somebody was saying that these planes which hit the World Trade Center, you know, couldn't have caused the damage. And in fact, that not only that, but the planes weren't actually real planes. You know, some had said they were remote controlled, and then there was somebody else that said that they weren't actually real. And it had started to come to the fore that, if you look at the actual damage, and you looked at some of the videos appeared to show different things. They should both show the same plane, particularly on the second impact. But if you study them closely, and I recommend that people go and watch a film called September Clues, which is made by Simon Shack, and he's done quite a good job of collecting together the videos and sort of picking them apart. You know, it's available on the internet in several places, this film. And I'd started to look at this, and I wasn't. A lot of people were really, you know, really saying, "Oh, this is just ridiculous. You know, that's just stupid saying there were no planes. Of course there were planes. Everyone saw them. We've got all the films, all the pictures. So to say there were no planes hitting the World Trade Center, that's just, you know, totally stupid." And they were getting really, you know, rude and horrible to people that were suggesting this, which I kind of took as a bit of a red flag, because I was thinking, "Hang on." You know, there's something here that which needs to be looked at. And people had been looking at this for 2 and 3 years before I had, you know. So I just really started to follow through what they'd already posted. And there were really, I think, three people. There was Gerard Holmgren, who's sadly passed away now, There's another person called Rosalie Grable, who goes under the pseudonym of Web Fairy. And there were a few others as well. There was another chap called Ace Baker. And then there was Nico Haupt, who I think is based in New York. And they were looking at this idea and the evidence that the planes that struck the World Trade Center weren't real. And I started to really study that more and more. And the split in this scholars group started to develop because Dr. Morgan Reynolds, he posted this paper, which was, you know, a sort of a formal analysis of this. And he'd written this paper with a materials engineering graduate. I'm trying to remember the exact title that he had. It was called Rick Reiter. And they posted this article, which was about, I don't know, 20, 30 pages long. And you've got all these diagrams in it and shown how these holes in the World Trade Center were actually slightly too small for the planes, you know, and stuff like this. And so that's a bit strange. And they showed that the plane didn't even decelerate when it hit the face of the tower, which again breaks the laws of physics. So we had two problems. We had the laws of physics being broken by the free fall collapse, because as Eric Hushmid said, it's impossible for a building to fall through itself as quickly as it falls through thin air, because a building isn't air, you know, a building is a building. So it's perfectly obvious right. that's the case. So we're getting more and more problems coming up here, and this created a real, you know, lot of arguing in the scholars group. And then what happened was Dr. Morgan Reynolds and another lady called Dr. Judy Wood, they posted this big long paper about how the World Trade Center was destroyed and all this dust and these strange holes in the building, and that some of the issues with the planes, you know, that the planes couldn't have cut through the girders, which I began to realize was correct, because we've got this thing in physics, and it's called Newton's third law. And this is one that, you know, many people will have actually heard of, and it's Newton's third law is, it's to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. You know, it's sometimes used in political circles, you know, to say that, you know, there's going to be a reaction to sort of controversial things being done. But in physics, what that means is if you punch a brick wall with your hand, the force on your hand is the same as the force on the wall. And as you know, your hand is very much weaker and more susceptible to damage than the wall is. So if you punch a wall, it's going to hurt. And by the same token, a plane is made of light materials and they're very brittle. And if you look on certain planes, you'll see a sign on the wing saying, do not step on the wing. No step, it says. In other words, if you're on one of these planes where, you know, you can get out of the cockpit and you might accidentally step on the wing, you obviously know not to do that because your foot go right through it. Because basically the wing is very, very light. And the same is true of a Boeing plane. So when you go and look at the pictures from the World Trade Center, you know, you can go and look at them, you don't need to take my word for it, you will see that some of these steel girders are cut into the shape of a plane, including the wings. And this is actually physically impossible. It cannot happen. And this was one of the reasons, and it wasn't the only reason, there were many reasons when you study it more, why we couldn't have had the planes doing the damage and making those holes in the face of the World Trade Center. Is not possible, and it's really not a question of debate. It is literally an open and shut case. Now people to this day will argue it, and they will say, yes, well, of course there were planes. They weren't flown by Al Qaeda. They were remote controlled drones flown by the CIA or the military or some faction of paramilitary groups or something. You know, they'll come out with some argument like that, but it's not possible. Whatever hit, I don't know what hit the World Trade Center. What I can tell you is the things that hit the World Trade Center were not planes. I can also tell you that many people, because I studied the witness accounts, this is one thing I did later, many people saw planes. I have no doubt that they saw planes. And we have all the videos. Some of the videos appear to be genuine. Some of them appear to be fake. And they show planes. But at all three sites, at the World Trade Center, at the Pentagon, and at Shanksville, we don't have any parts that have been recovered with serial numbers on them. We don't have... only at the World Trade Center do we have a couple of large bits of wreckage. We have a couple of wheels. And a couple of tires and things. We don't have any large wing sections that fell down. No sections of the tail broke off. This is the other thing. When you start looking at it, it becomes blatantly obvious that planes couldn't have crashed, because, you know, you think of simple real-world examples such as an IndyCar race, as you might call it over there. We would call it a Formula One race, where you have the car crashing into the barrier at high speed, going out of control. The car will then spin round and go down the track, and bits will fly off it. That's because the forward motion of the car, you know, when it's travelling at high speed, is then turned into a rotational motion. I think the correct name for that is translation. And that's when the car starts spinning. Now, the same would have happened with the plane. If the plane had come in at a slight angle, then the wings would have partly broken off, or the tail section would have broken off and fallen into the street. If you go back and watch every single one of those videos, you will see the plane goes into the building completely. None of the tail sections or the tail flaps or the wing flaps or the ailerons, no seats come out of the plane and fall down. There is no large bits of debris break off that plane and fall to the ground.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Somebody asked a question in the chat room, definitely can see wings going outside the building, see the outside of the building, the wings. But we cover that afterwards.
Right. Yeah? Sure.
Okay. Thanks. We're on a break again.
Throughout history, the power to issue money has been used to enslave man into a perpetual system of debt.
I think we can talk. Yeah, somebody says you see the wings coming from the building, outside the building.
No, you don't. You see the wings going into the building. You certainly don't see them breaking off and falling into the street. You just got to look at the videos again, and you'll see that the plane, some people call it the butter plane. I didn't give it that name. They say the plane's made of butter and just melts into the building.
Right, and there was another one. Another thing what was said was those wings are made to withstand things hidden in high speed.
Yeah, but not steel buildings.
Yeah, right.
You know, the wings are easily damaged. I mean, you can show that very simply, and they're quite brittle. Because otherwise it wouldn't fly.
Do you think all these videos have been manipulated?
Well, I think some of them have. That's a tough question to answer, which is why I basically stop at saying I know that what hit wasn't a plane because of the physical damage that was caused. And I'll mention a couple of more aspects. You could almost do a whole 2 hours just on that. And people do get stuck on it because it's so they think what they've shown must be true. It breaks the laws of physics,
Right, and see people, even I do not understand the laws of physics, like you have studied, and this is really what people have to understand, Us as layman's people think we know it, but I have got no clue either.
Well,
but it's still interesting,
Yeah, absolutely. But, I then, after this, got in touch with Dr. Judy Wood, who's, much more qualified than I am. And she has she's got her specialisms in materials engineering science. She has a bachelor's degree, a master's, and a PhD. So she knows her stuff. That's what I'll come on to after I've talked a bit more about the plane issue.
Okay. So I'm just going to be quiet for a minute.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, I think we're back on air. It's now 1:47, and I've got Ms. Andrew on about talking about 9/11 and his investigation, what he figured out so far. Andrew, we had somebody saying in the chat room that the wings should be withstanding a lot of more. Reason being, just in case something will, when the planes are in the air, something will hit it like a bird or whatever. So,
right.
Can you explain that?
Well, of course, the plane will sort of, it will resist a little bit of damage, but a bird is not a building, is it? I mean, you know, you only have to compare, for example, the construction of the towers, which I can talk about briefly. If you look at the construction of the towers, you have 236 exterior steel columns, 3-inch box girder steel. Now, why are planes made of aluminium and light materials and buildings made of steel and concrete? It's because steel and concrete is strong and, you know, made to sort of withstand, you know, the effects of wind. Certainly with a tall building like that, you need a lot of, you know, load-bearing members. And a plane is made of light materials so that it will fly. Now, we're presented with this, when you study it, it's actually a ridiculous picture that these planes went into the building. And you don't see any of the wings break off. You know, you just go and watch the videos again. You don't see any large sections of the plane break off and fall into the street. You see some little sort of tiny, you know, they look like almost grains coming down. Obviously, when you scale it up, they'd be bigger than that. But the pieces that appear to fall into the street are probably no bigger than something like, I don't know, 6 or 12 inches across maximum. So it's like the plane completely shreds. Now, again, people say, oh, well, Andrew, that's just ridiculous, because actually what's happening is the planes are travelling so fast that they shredded. Now, of course, this, again, is ridiculous, because if you go and look at the specifications for a Boeing aircraft and you look at what actually happened, the planes were flying at about 700 feet above sea level. Now, the NIST reports, for example, these technical reports that I mentioned earlier on, they claim that the planes impacted onto the buildings, I think it's like 526 and 542 miles an hour. I can't remember the exact figures, but you can go and look in their technical reports or Google it or whatever, and you'll find that it's approximately 500 miles an hour these planes are claimed to have hit the towers. There's one big problem with that story, and that's that at 700 feet above sea level, the air is much thicker than it is at 25,000 or 30,000 feet. So if a Boeing was to try and travel at 500 miles an hour at 700 feet above sea level, it would shake itself to bits. Essentially, it would be very difficult to control. It's debatable whether it would even be able to travel at that speed because of the problems with the amount of air it has to suck into the engines and the thickness of the air. So again, you have to think about this carefully and take in all the factors like that. The other problem with that particular plane story, and there are many, I don't want to stick on this for too long, I know it's difficult for people.
No.
So there's other things I want to discuss. But the other problem with this plane story, there are many, but I've mentioned a couple, and that's we have a lady called Edna Cintron, who is seen, I think it's on World Trade Center number 2, she's actually holding a girder and waving at people where this supposed plane has gone into the building. And yet we're told that we have these huge raging fires from the kerosene, and yet just literally just above her head, maybe 5 or 10 feet above her head, you see this blackened hole where this plane was, and yet where she is, it is apparently there's almost no heat because she's hanging on to the steel girders, you know, and she's waving to people. Mm. She's perfectly fine. And again, you can see these videos of her waving. So that's another problem with the plane story. The other problem is that because I investigated this more thoroughly, I went and did a study of 500 witness accounts, and this is on my website. I've called the article "Going in Search of Planes in New York City," and I was prompted to do this because of a later legal case which arose. And Dr. Morgan Reynolds, the person that wrote this paper with Rick Reiter about the planes, he later turned this into a what's called a QITAM case, a legal case against NIST contractors, because he claimed that NIST should have detected that this plane crash couldn't have happened. It broke the laws of physics because NIST is made up of people, you know, who have scientific qualifications in scientific subjects. So they should know what I'm telling you is true. And apparently they didn't, or if they did, they were willfully negligent in keeping, you know, that analysis from the report.
Right.
But in doing the witness study, which if you go onto the New York Times website, there are 500 witness accounts from around the time of 9/11. They were taken over a period, I think, of about 6 or 8 months after the events. And I basically downloaded all these accounts, all 500 of them. It took me about 2 weeks to do all of this study. And I searched through all the accounts for the word plane, and then I looked and found out where these people were, if I could work out where they are, and they would in the account say, well, we parked our truck on Vesey Street, or we parked our truck on West Street or West Broadway, and you can look on the map so you can see exactly where they were in relation to the World Trade Center. And I established that there were about, I forget the exact numbers, it's all on the website, but there were about 100 people within these accounts that were right next to the World Trade Center when the supposed second plane hit. So these are the people that were right there in the thick of it. Some of them had arrived earlier, some had arrived just when the events were unfolding, and so on. And I established from reading their accounts that out of about 100 people, only about 20 heard the plane before it hit, and only about 20 saw it, and only about 8 saw and heard the plane, and which is very strange. I mean, I can understand people not seeing the plane, because if they're busy, you know, these were the people that were involved in the study were called first responders. In other words, they were the people that were pulling people out of the wreckage. They were emergency medical technicians, emergency medical personnel, and firemen. So, you know, you can imagine if they're sort of pulling, you know, working their way through building or wreckage or trying to help somebody, they may not be looking up. So they may not have seen the plane. That's fine. But these planes, if they'd come where they would have been louder than a rock concert. Louder than a rock concert. That's the, I think it's 130 decibels of sound from one of these engines. And, of course, in somewhere like New York City, you think about it, you've got all that hard, those hard surfaces of all the buildings, the glass, the brickwork, the concrete of the asphalt on the streets, and all that is going to reflect the sound. It's not like you've got a lot of grass in front of a rock concert which would absorb, and a lot of people which would absorb the sound. So you're going to get an awful lot of noise from a Boeing jet coming near those towers. Mm-hmm. And yet, we've got one account, there's probably more than one actually, but there's one that sticks in my mind. And I could actually read this account out. It'll take me a few minutes to get to it. But basically, the chap, he's underneath the fireball of the second plane exploding. And he says, I'll see if I can get his words. I've just about got it here. Let's see if I can get his words. He says, we start heading down the block. This is from a firefighter called David Sandvik. We start heading down the block and we get down to, I guess, about Church Street. And the second plane hit, which, you know, so he explicitly says that. Mm-hmm. And I remember just being underneath. I never heard the motor of the plane, the sound of the engines. We just heard the explosion. You felt the explosion. And looking straight up, and seeing that fireball that you see on the news, but we're underneath looking up now at it. So, hang on a minute. This guy's right under where the plane hit, looking up at the fire when he didn't hear the plane engine of the plane. That's a bit strange. Yeah. And again, when you look at these, you know, I looked at a couple of hundred of these. I didn't read every single word, but I picked out certain pieces. And there's another one here I've got. Scott Hollowatch. Hollowack, Hollowach. At that time, Chief Ganshi was behind me, and he thought there was another explosion in the North Tower. And that's when I turned around and said, Chief, listen, there is a second plane that hit the tower. He was like, no, we have another explosion. I said, no, Chief, I witnessed it. I watched the plane hit the other tower. He's like, are you sure? I said, Chief, I'm 100% positive I watched the second plane hit the other tower. Which, I mean, this means that there are two people stood next to each other near the tower, and they can't agree that a plane has struck. I mean, doesn't that strike you as odd? You know?
Well, yeah, it strikes me as odd, but then somebody in the chat was saying, well, they cut the engines. But, you know, me personally, I think that's the last thing I would think about if I would try to drive a plane into a tower. Well, let's cut the engines.
Right.
Because
you want
to be quiet.
And
that's only my...
I know what you mean. So you can, you know, this is one of the problems. You can argue it several ways, but when you read all these accounts that I have done, rather than just sort of say, "Oh, this must be what happened," that must be what happened. Mm-hmm. In other words, what I'm talking about is the difference between speculation and looking at the evidence, mm-hmm. which is a very key thing that you must do if you want to know if I'm just making this stuff up or I'm actually telling you the truth. Then you need to go and look at the evidence. And that's what you need to do. And it's not, you know, it takes time. I've been looking at this for 7 years, you know, and it takes an awful lot of time. So, You can't just say, oh, well, I think that must have happened. Oh, well, I think that must have happened because of reason X. You have to look at all the evidence. And like, you know, going back, now we sort of take a step back, backwards and forwards and sideways from this, because I'd assumed that this thermite story that, I mentioned with the molten metal and things, I'd assumed that was true because it was coming out of the mouth of a physics professor and a few other people that are supporting him. And Morgan Reynolds, the chap that had questioned the plane stories, he then started to question the molten metal. And I think we'll hear the music again.
We can hear the music again, and everybody get yourself a cup of coffee or something, and we'll be right back. Thank you. And now we're back on live, and there's Ziggy plays guitar. I wish I could play guitar. I'm trying to play the flute. Not working, guys. Not working at all. And we are back now, and I've got Andrew Johnson with me, and I will let him have the floor again. Andrew, you with me?
I'm with you. Yes.
Oh, thank you.
And we were talking about these sort of business with the planes at the World Trade Center, which again is very difficult for people to accept, you know. And all I can say is I used to believe the official story of 9/11, like most everyone else, and then I sort of came across the alternative knowledge about it and got into that. But basically, you know, I was reading out some of these accounts from the witnesses who were actually there, and I recommend that, you know, people go and study some of these, because there were some very, very peculiar things within these witness accounts, which I'll probably come back to from a slightly different angle later. But I'd started to point out about the scholars group that I was in, and Dr. Morgan Reynolds had written this article questioning the stories of the planes, and that, you know, like I think we had in the chat room in a small way, it would, like, no, people say, oh, no, that's just totally, you're just trying to discredit, you know, and you're just saying it to make people disbelieve you, so you must be a disinformation agent, you know, and all this. You get all that kind of talk, and then people don't actually go and study the evidence, which is what you actually need to do before making these claims. And so Morgan Reynolds had written this paper criticising this other character, Steve Nee Jones, who'd come out with a thermite story, and he'd also teamed up with another person called Dr. Judy Wood. And in this paper they'd written about Steve Nee Jones, they mentioned my name, because I'd helped Steve Jones make this little video clip about thermite, and I think it was early 2006 I did this, and it was about 6 months later that Dr. Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds mentioned my name. And I sort of said, oh, I was a bit surprised they mentioned me, because I was just, you know, wasn't really, you know, didn't have a PhD or anything like that. And I ended up writing to Morgan Reynolds, I think. And, he wrote back and sort of, I basically wrote to him and said, oh, yeah, I did make the video for Steve Nee Jones. I'll just like to confirm that I did actually do that. And anyway, I think the next thing after that was about November 2006. And I'd started to look at Dr. Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds' research more closely, and I was studying it and trying to, you know, sort of come to some conclusions about it. And I realised that they were onto something here. And then in November 2006, Dr. Judy Wood did a show with Jim Fetzer, and she basically laid out in that show the evidence that the buildings weren't taken down with thermite at all. And in fact, what had happened to them, they were actually destroyed with some type of energy weapon. And of course everyone said, oh, well, that's just ridiculous. You know, you're clearly that's disinformation, because energy weapons don't exist. I mean, you only hear about those things in science fiction films, and it's just all this, you know. And this Steve Nee Jones character, he then came along and he described it as ray beams from space, or space ray, or I can't remember the exact words. I think it was ray beams from space was the expression. And of course everyone jumped on that and started saying, oh, Dr. Judy Wood comes out with space beams. And expects people to believe her. You know, we're trying to build a truth movement, and then she comes out with this, you know, this ray beam from space silliness. I mean, where's that going to get us? You know, and she was like lambasted for this. But I began to study the evidence that she laid out, and looking at her credentials, you know, she had a PhD in materials engineering science, she had a master's in engineering mechanics, bachelor's in civil engineering. This was one very well qualified lady, you know. And yeah. She basically showed these pictures, and some of them are very straightforward. She, for example, there's no point in listening to me talking about this particularly, you have to go and look at the pictures that she has on her website. And if you go to the website, drjudywood.com, that's drjudywood.com, and then you put a forward slash and you put WTC for World Trade Center, the initials for that, you will see she's laid out a selection of images. Now, she looked at approximately 40,000 images from the World Trade Center destruction, from before and after and during the destruction of the World Trade Center. And she basically said, well, look, if you look at the pictures in sequence, you know, put them in sort of time sequence, look at the order that things happened in for a start. She observed, for example, that when you look at the seismic signature, then it's 2.6 for one of the buildings, I think 2.4 or 2.3 for the other. And she said, well, looking at that, it looks like about three quarters of the building didn't hit the ground. And everyone said, well, how does that happen? Because surely it was thermite. Surely the building broke into pieces and therefore it must have hit the ground. And she said, no, well, no, it didn't, because the seismic signature said that it didn't. Because if you cut a building into chunks, whether it's using thermite, explosives, nuclear devices, which has been posited, planes, jet fuel, if you cut the building into chunks some way, those chunks are going to hit the ground. So when they hit the ground, they're going to create a seismic signature. And, you know, if you look at the way this seismic signature actually comes out, the buildings didn't hit the ground. And that's what she showed. And she also showed, for example, this picture where there's World Trade Center number 7 in the background. And that means, we know that World Trade Center number 7, which wasn't hit by anything, and most people assume that was a controlled demolition, those that have actually looked at the, you know, questioned the official story, but it wasn't a controlled demolition. That's now been established that it wasn't that. Again, because one of the main reasons being the seismic signature. But we'll stick with Tower 1 and 2, and you look at this picture, which was taken at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you can see this on the WTC page that I mentioned, and you'll see that we've got building number 7 in the background, and then in the foreground we have two buildings which are not there. And this was taken, if you look at the angle of the sun, it's probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, because there's very few shadows. The shadows are very short. So it's around about sort of 1 or 2 in the afternoon or something. And so where did the buildings go? And then she looks at pictures halfway through the destruction, where you can actually see the buildings literally turning to dust. And you look at the videos and you can see a 70-story high section of the core of tower number 1, I think it is. I always get mixed up whether it's tower number 1 or tower number 2, but I think it's tower number 1. And you can see this thing called the spire, and as you watch, the 70 columns of 70 stories of steel turns to dust before your very eyes. And it just literally within about 6 seconds it turns to dust. And again, if you watch some of these videos of the tower, the more of the close-up ones coming down, you can actually see, you know, and again, you're going to need to check this because, you know, you won't believe me. You'll accuse me of being disinfo, etc., etc., which is what I've had for the last 5 years or more. It's the buildings turned to dust. And not only that, that you look at what happened afterwards. You look at, for example, there were 9 levels under the World Trade Center. This is obviously well known. Figures were rescued from the mall stores. They had a Warner Brothers store in there that sold Warner Brothers merchandise, and you had these, like, you know, 6-foot-high figures. They were taken out from the mall stores and put into, you know, safekeeping somewhere. How did these stores underneath the World Trade Center survive undamaged, when you supposedly had 500,000 tons of rubble crashing down into these basements? How did these things survive? How did the PATH train survive? You know, how did the bathtub survive? Mm-hmm. The World Trade Center was actually built inside what's called the bathtub, which was designed to keep out the Hudson River, because, you know, the 9 floors were below sea level. And if this building had come down with controlled demolition, then this would have damaged the bathtub, and the any breaks in the bathtub would have caused Manhattan to flood, and then you would have had a serious problem in the subway system and so on. But none of these things happened. So, again, Dr. Judy Wood was making some very, very basic and simple observations, kind of like, you know, I tried to make about the free fall time. And she'd looked at that as well, and she'd done this thing called the billiard ball example, or the BBE, which was kind of like a more elegant discussion of this free fall thing, you know, where the towers came down in 9 seconds. She'd kind of broken this down a bit more and made it simpler for people to see that it couldn't possibly have been a pancake collapse, as the official story claimed. It couldn't possibly be that these floors had burned through or anything like that. We could clearly see that the building had actually disappeared. It had turned to dust before it hit the ground. So this was obviously very, very difficult for people to accept. So all the cries that I've mentioned were repeated louder and louder. But that didn't really deter Dr. Wood, and essentially neither did it deter me, because in early 2007, there was a very, it's now become a sort of infamous thing. There was an interview that Dr. Judy Wood gave, and it was at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and she went to see a presentation by Jim Fetzer there. She didn't give a presentation there, but somehow people there knew that she was going to be coming to this event, and then she was kind of sort of like semi-ambushed by this physicist called Dr. Greg Jenkins, who was at the University of Maryland. And he then did this interview with her and said, well, you know, what
Street, power to issue money.
We are on a break. Yeah, I didn't realize either. So we're going to be back soon. And I would like to apologize to the caller who called. I missed your call. And today I will not take any calls. So I would like to, Andrew, just to keep on talking. Thank you. Hey, everybody, it's me again, Ziggy. Listen, I just want to apologize to a caller who called in. I totally missed your call, so I do apologize for that. This show, I'm not going to take any calls, but Mr. Andrew Johnson is willing to come back in a couple of weeks, and he will answer any question you have got. So because it's my first show, I thought, you know, I'm not going to take any calls. I just would like to hear Mr. Johnson's point of view. So I was really formal there, Andrew.
Yeah, that's
so,
all right.
Mr. Johnson, you have the floor again.
Thank you, Ms. Ziggy. Mrs. Ziggy, I don't know what to call you.
Just call me Ziggy. Call me what you like, but don't be too rude.
Okay. I'll try not to. I can come on again and, you know, do phone calls and stuff like that. But I do encourage people to check out checktheevidence.com, drjudywood.com, and we'll probably mention one other site shortly. But basically, Dr. Judy Wood was really the key to unlocking my understanding, because I think about 9/11, because also what I'd been doing, you know, I've mentioned about the scholars group and some other bits and pieces. And the scholars group essentially began to break up because of this so-called, you know, controversial, in quotation marks, research of Morgan Reynolds and Judy Wood. And they were accused of bringing the truth movement into disrepute and all this kind of nonsense, which actually was completely the opposite of what they were doing. Because when Dr. Judy Wood had studied this destruction of the buildings sufficiently, she decided that she would then challenge NIST, in other words, these reports, which were published by NIST that I referred to earlier, the 10,000 pages of reports, she decided, with the help of an attorney, that she would challenge these reports on a legal basis. And how you do that is that within the United States, there is a law called the DQA, the Data Quality Act, and that allows you to challenge a company or organization such that if they've produced a report, you know, that they've taken money to produce, that report has to be of sufficient quality. And if you find any mistakes or whatever, you can actually have some comeback, you know, and be compensated if their report is fraudulent. And so what Dr. Wood did was she first filed a request for correction to NIST, and that was on April the 16th, 2007. In other words, she took the evidence about the buildings turning to dust and the seismic signature and the lack of debris and some of the witness accounts, and there's a number of other things which indicate that energy effects were involved, which we haven't really got to yet. And she put that into a 50-page document. She sent it to NIST and said, right, you need to correct your report because the data that I've collected proves that your report is incorrect. And they basically turned around and said, no, well, our report is fine. You know, we're not going to address the data that you've assembled. It's, you know, it's not going to change anything. And, you know, basically, we're not going to change it. So she then sued them. Well, in fact, she didn't sue NIST because NIST used 23 contractors, some of which were defense companies. And they produced sections of the report. So she sued the 23 contractors and she basically said, look, I'm a professor of mechanical engineering. I've, you know, studied materials, and I can see from the research that I've done that you've been willfully negligent in not explaining the phenomena that I've catalogued, and therefore you are going to be sued for science fraud, which is what she did. Mm-hmm. Now, if we go back to this Stephen E. Jones character, and this is very important that I mention this for those that are still stuck in the thermite paradigm, you can go and look at the request for correction that was filed by Stephen E. Jones and Richard Gage and several others, and that was filed, I think, on April the 10th or something, 2007. If you download that document and look for the word thermite in it, you will not find the word thermite in their document, except within a URL, which is a link to a paper that has now changed since it was written and has a disclaimer on it. So in other words, this group that's been going around for 6 years now claiming that thermite was involved in some form did not mention that in its request for correction to NIST, whereas Dr. Judy Wood, who has presented the evidence that actually some type of energy weapon was involved in the destruction of the towers, which again we'll try and get to shortly, she put all that evidence into the report. She talked about energy effects and directed energy and all of this, and curiously, these directed energy weapons, which do exist, you can go and look at them. Curiously, there are two companies that are mentioned as being contractors to NIST. One is called Science Applications International Corporation, and the other one is Applied Research Associates. And they both have websites, so you can go and look at what they do. And they produce, would you believe it, directed energy weapons, systems or components, or they do research in those areas. So isn't that strange that you would have two companies, mm-hmm. all the companies in the USA that would have expertise in the way buildings are designed, you have at least two that also have specialisms in directed energy weapons, which was exactly what Dr. Wood was talking about. And she pointed this out to NIST and said, well, she thought there might be a conflict of interest here, which of course they denied. Mm-hmm. So she then sued them for science fraud, and essentially the case was dismissed, as you might expect. But in mm-hmm. It's worth reading the judge's ruling, because if you read Judge Daniel's ruling on the case, it mentions in the ruling the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the moon landing hoax, which of course had nothing to do with anything that Dr. Wood had submitted to the court. So they weren't even evaluating the evidence. It wasn't judged on the evidence, is what I'm saying. So a court is supposed to, you know, you submit the evidence to court, the court talks about the evidence, you know, and then the case is either taken on or it's dismissed. But in the dismissal, they didn't mention any of the evidence. And in fact, they used some of the defendant's words, I believe, in the ruling. It was like they were biased towards the defendants, which, you know, let's be honest, the military-industrial complex companies.
Right.
You know, so there's not really too many surprises there. But, of course, Stephen E. Jones, they never even filed a legal case. In fact, they couldn't file a legal case because, as I see things, this thermite story is actually a fraud, and you therefore cannot challenge a fraud in court with another fraud, because once you go under cross-examination from the defendants, the fraud will be revealed. But Judy Wood's court case was never heard, or essentially it was never heard. There was an appeal lodged, and that they had an 8-minute hearing in the Southern District of New York, in June 2009, but then again that appeal was dismissed too, and the appeal document, if you read that was quite interesting, because they decided to ignore a change in the law in allowing them to dismiss the case, and they actually stated that in the ruling. So in other words, the court, which is supposed to operate based on certain laws, decided that in this particular case they were going to ignore the change in the law so that they could more easily dismiss the case. So, right. And they actually said that in the document. So, you know, again, this is not disinformation. this is actually information that people can find out for themselves if they do enough research. Mm-hmm. And somebody who is a disinformation agent doesn't submit a court case. Now, we've talked about energy effects. I can also mention briefly that that issue with the plane that I talked about, that was the subject of Morgan Reynolds' legal case, and he also filed a science fraud case, and that was dismissed, but he didn't appeal. He just left it. Once it was dismissed, they decided that they would try and appeal Dr. Wood's case and put all the emphasis into that, because that was a more important case. And Morgan Reynolds' case was also dismissed, but the judge used the same document, even though the evidence submitted in the case was completely different. So, really, essentially what happened from then on, Dr. Judy Wood was continuing her research, and I'd started talking to her almost daily, actually, by then. We'd got in touch, and, you know, I'd looked at certain very peculiar things, and I'd looked at something called the Hutchison effect, which was an energy effect, and I'd been familiar with that. Actually, 10 years earlier, I came across the Hutchison effect, 1999. And in fact, I think we've got some more music.
And I can hear lovely music again. So it looks like this time is going so fast. Yes. It's unbelievable. So, you know, but before, when you come back, can you answer me this question? Who's actually funded Dr. Wood's case? Herself?
Yeah.
Other people?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll tell you about that.
Oh, thank you. Right. It's now 2:33 on Saturday, Ziggy's first show, and she can't play guitar. Anyway, back to Andrew. And yeah, I just wanted to ask you, the question really, that did Dr. Woods fund her own case and the other gentleman too?
Essentially she funded her own case. Certainly the initial stages she funded herself. Now the attorney that contacted her, because there was an attorney called Jerry Leapheart who was based in Connecticut, so that was quite handy because he's only about an hour outside New York, you know, and I went to stay with them in 2008 when we were sort of doing this research. You know, I paid my own fare over to the States, which cost me about £400, you know, which is probably about $700. And that was, you know, it just came out of my own money. And then attorney Jerry Leapheart, he essentially gave his time to the case for free. Dr. Wood paid the administrative costs. And I think, you know, when an attorney gives their time for free, the costs of filing a case aren't huge. You know, I think it's probably $700,000 to $800,000. I'm not sure of the actual cost. But what did cost was when we did the appeal hearings for the appeal case, because they had to photocopy, I think, about several thousand pages of multiple submissions, which needed to be done. And the cost of that, for that, I think, was $5,000. So at that point, Dr. Wood put out an appeal to us, to a group of us, and I went around a group of my friends. I think I sent in about $400 or $500 of my own money. I can't remember the exact fee. And then I got probably a roughly equivalent amount from about seven or eight people that I knew. They each gave sort of like $50, $60 or whatever dollars they could afford. And we ended up getting about, I think, $700-$800 from over here, and then a few people in the States that we knew contributed. So the appeals were filed in time, and we got all the documents filed. And I also, you know, my part in that, really, I mean, Dr. Wood did all the work, really. She did all the, put all the evidence together. I sort of helped prepare some of the documents, because there were some ancillary documents that needed formatting, and, you know, we basically took the contracts off the NIST website, and then we formatted those into a little table, and, you know, then that needed to be, we wrote into the table why they hadn't met that contractual obligation, which is basically because what they ended up doing was false, you know, and we could prove it, and we still can prove it. So that, yeah, that was all self-funded. And, of course, everyone was still going around saying, oh, you know, this energy weapon space beam nonsense, you know. So there was no support, really, from what you might call the 9/11 truth movement. Quite the reverse. In fact, they were quite hostile to the case. Mm-hmm. And then when the appeal was, dismissed, both times some people actually celebrated this. You know, and you could probably read some of the forums. They actually were glad that this wasn't progressed. Mm-hmm. They didn't sort of come along and say, well, you know, well, actually, you know, if you'd have done this or you'd have done this, you know, maybe you would have got further. They didn't say anything like that. They didn't sort of start their own action. No, no. They just sort of criticised, and they ridiculed what Dr. Wood had tried to do. But anyway, what essentially happened during the court cases, while during the process that it was filed, is actually the mechanism and the technology of how the towers were destroyed was discovered by Dr. Judy Wood, and it's something relating to what's called the Hutchison effect, which I'll need to spend a few minutes explaining because people have probably not heard of this, at least not in this context. Now, we talked about energy weapons. In other words, it wasn't explosives, it wasn't nuclear devices which took down the towers. It was basically an energy system. It's actually based on a principle of what is known as field interference. And what this chap called John Hutchison was doing, he'd been doing this research since 1979. And many people will have heard of a physicist called Nikola Tesla, and he actually invented the AC current system, which drives all our mains power, you know, that we use in the organized Western cultures that we have today. And Nikola Tesla invented this system in the early 1900s, and Nikola Tesla also, it seems, did the first radio transmission. He actually did that before Marconi. And Nikola Tesla also did the first X-ray photograph. So he was a pretty smart guy, to say the least. And he'd started to look into the idea that you could get energy out of the environment, free energy, and you could set things up in a certain way using electrical fields to draw out energy from the zero-point field and use it to do things for you. And this is what John Hutchison was interested in. And he started looking at Nikola Tesla's notebooks, and he started building equipment, as I say, in the late 70s, early 80s. And he started getting together some radar equipment, some radio frequency generators, which are used for generating radio signals of various kinds. He got microwave generators, which are used in microwave ovens and in radar equipment. And he also got electrostatic field generators, such as a Van de Graaff generator or a Tesla coil, which is where we have the time with Tesla. And he was mixing together these different types of fields in his apartment, and he was doing this in Canada, and he was doing this in Vancouver for a while, and he ended up in New Westminster. I think he moved there in the late 90s or early 2000s. Basically, he was producing some very strange effects. He was actually able to turn bars of metal into jelly in the middle, and so you get this metal bar bending. A solid metal bar would bend in the middle, and he'd also get these strange effects of levitation. In other words, he put this cannonball in his sample area, and there's this on video. People can go and look at the videos, and you'll see this cannonball lifting up, and it actually turns round whilst it's in midair. And he's creating this levitation and some very strange effects like this. But when this metal bends, there is no heat. In other words, after he switches off the equipment and picks out the metal a few minutes later, it's not hot. It's not at all hot. And in fact, in certain cases, as Dr. Wood later discovered when she visited him, the metal has become magnetized. And it's actually become magnetized in the middle, but not at the ends in one of his samples. So you're getting all these very strange effects. And what do you know? John Hutchison was visited by a team from Los Alamos National Laboratories in 1983 to look at his research. And they worked with him for 4 months because they were very interested in these metal bending and levitation effects. And, of course, if you go onto the internet, you'll hear all these stories about John Hutchison being a fake and a fraud. And he makes these videos that are upside down because he uses magnets and blah, blah, blah. And round it goes. But what you'll see if you look at Dr. Wood's research is that all the effects that John Hutchison has created are seen in the evidence that from the World Trade Center. You have bent beams bent into a horseshoe shape. You have people being levitated. David Hansher, the New York Daily News photographer, he was levitated and carried a block. And you can hear him talk about that in an interview from October 2001. And I show this in the presentation I give. We have upside down cars near the World Trade Center. We have strange rusting effects. We have jellified metal, where the metal is actually mangled into a sort of strange form. We also have ongoing effects. This is all catalogued on Dr. Wood's site. And not only that, but within this scholars group, when I started to talk about the Hutchison effect and said, yep, Dr. Judy Wood's right, this character that I mentioned called Jim Fetzer, he started to attack us, whereas up until that point, before we'd mentioned the Hutchison effect, he'd been actually quite supportive of the research. Mm-hmm. So people can go and read my book, which is called 9/11 Finding the Truth, and it's available from my website. It's a free download. You can read all of that book. It's 370 pages long. It catalogues the whole sorry story of how essentially what happened was when Dr. Judy Wood broke ranks and started talking about energy weapons, she was attacked. When I broke ranks with her and joined with her and said it was the Hutchison effect that was important, I was attacked and I was lambasted for this. And not only that, but John Hutchison, when we talked to him, because we were able to get in touch with him, he actually submitted an affidavit for Judy Wood's court case. And what that means is that if he was found to be committing perjury, he could have been prosecuted had the court case gone forward to discovery. So he was willing to undergo cross-examination about his research, and he put in a 30-page affidavit. And within that affidavit, there is a letter from a Canadian MP called Chuck Cook. And in that letter, it talks about how John Hutchison's research was classified by the Canadian government as a matter of national security. So why would they be doing that to somebody who's committing fraud? Of course they wouldn't do that. And guess what? Stephen E. Jones, the character who talks about thermite, he was involved in the cold fusion research in the 1980s, and cold fusion is another energy phenomenon which we think is related to the Hutchison effect. And Steve Jones also worked for a time at Los Alamos National Laboratories, which is where this John Alexander character came from to go and investigate John Hutchison. So all this evidence, all these connections are laid out on my website and in my book, and people can find them all if they want to go and explore them. Because essentially what happened on 9/11 was the technology that was used was based on what's called free energy. It liberated energy from within the environment, and that energy was carefully controlled using a number of different fields, and that's how they destroyed the World Trade Center.
Okay, now I can hear the music again, and I was totally mesmerized. I was totally listening to what you were saying. So I'm really enjoying this. Thank you very much. So we'll be back soon. Right, it's not 2:47, and anyway, Andrew, I'll let you have the floor again. I was going to ask you something, and I forgot all about it. But you carry on, please.
Yeah, so really what I was going to say was that Dr. Judy Wood had established that this was a result of something like the Hutchison effect. We don't know if it was exactly the same thing as the Hutchison effect, this set of energy effects, and people need to research into this, because people often think of 9/11 and most commonly think of it as just about being about to do with the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, and they wanted to get some control of the oil supply and this sort of thing, which is true, I think. I would agree with those people, but there's a whole other dimension to this, and that's to do with energy. And you will only uncover that dimension if you study the evidence. And he who controls the energy supply controls the destiny of the human race, because we all use oil. Even in the poorest African countries, they still use oil to power their agricultural machinery and this sort of thing. So the control of the oil is important. And also, anything that threatens that control is important, both in terms of, threatening the oil supply itself, or in terms of a technology which would make anything to do with oil-powered systems redundant. And that's what is behind this weapon. It's a free energy system. It seems to be related to cold fusion, as I've already mentioned. As soon as we put this evidence on the table in 2008, we were essentially attacked. And that continues up until this day. And you'll see it, you'll hear that I'm a disinformation agent, you hear that Judy Wood is just a crackpot, and I've got a whole presentation about this where I go through all of this nonsense that they come out with. Fact of the matter is, the people presenting this thermite theory have not taken their evidence to court. Dr. Judy Wood has. John Hutchison submitted an affidavit, as I said. So, we know that this is true. So it's up to other people to determine whether we are right or not, because we're just two people essentially, and there's a small group of others now. I would also tell you that Dr. Judy Wood has published all this in more detail in her book, Where Did the Towers Go?, which is retails for $40 plus shipping. And you can get that from wheredidthetowersgo.com. So if you really want to see this all written out in a good, clear format, you get that book. The person who wrote the foreword, Professor Eric Larson, he said that the book is the most important book of the 21st century. That's what he says in the opening words. So, you know, and I agree that's exactly what it is. But if you want to see the website, just go to drjudywood.com and you can walk through some of the pictures. That's more organized like a filing cabinet, though. So, you know, you'll see it like that. But the thing I haven't also touched on, which I must, there's one thing I've missed out, which I want to get in before the time is up.
Okay.
The other thing which Dr. Wood discovered, because going back to this Greg Jenkins interview, he basically was focusing on certain things. And one of the things he didn't want to talk about was the dust, because there was a lot of dust which came from these buildings. Now, in a conventional controlled demolition, the dust doesn't really go much above the height of the original building. But on 9/11, the dust from the World Trade Center seemed to keep going up and up and up. And this is something Dr. Judy Wood observed in the pictures. Something very odd about this dust. And so she decided to go and look for some satellite photographs, because she wanted to see where this dust was going. Was it going up into the atmosphere? And apparently, yes, it was. And she went and looked at satellite pictures. And guess what she saw on a satellite picture as well? She found a hurricane there. And there was a hurricane that was headed straight towards New York City. And in fact, if you go and look at the Hurricane Data Center, we even had some caller called into a radio show about a year ago when Dr. Judy Wood was on. He claimed she was lying about this hurricane, Hurricane Erin. This caller said she was misrepresenting the facts, and yet you can easily go onto the Hurricane Data Center. You can see that Hurricane Erin was the longest lasting hurricane of the 2001 season, first named on the 1st of September. Then it went up towards Bermuda, it hit Bermuda on the 7th, did a bit of damage there, which was reported by CNN. And then Hurricane Erin travelled in a straight line for 4 days towards New York City. It arrived about 500 miles off the coast of New York. It was still a way out, admittedly, but the field effects from the storm, the electrical, because there are electrical effects associated with the storm, as you know, lightning, thunder, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Dry thunder was reported at all three New York airports on 9/11, despite all the clear skies and everything. And the hurricane was closest to New York City. You can go and check the satellite pictures. It's all on Dr. Wood's site. You can go and click back to the Hurricane Data Center. It was closest to New York City, 8 o'clock in the morning. On the 12th, what did it do? It made a right-hand turn and headed off out towards Newfoundland. It also reached its widest expanse in area on 9/11. And the barometric pressure, the wind speed, and the temperature were all constant as measured at JFK Airport for between 16 and 24 hours over the events of 9/11. Something very, very strange was going on. So here we're taking people completely out of the political paradigm and this type of thing that they function in, and you're now talking energy effects, energy system, and of course weather control. Weather control. Who'd have thought that on 9/11, that weather control was used? But looking at what I've looked at, and I'd looked into weather control technology, such as that looked at by Wilhelm Reich in the 60s with his Cloudbuster technology, I'd looked at all of that before I came to Dr. Wood's research. I'd looked at that in sort of 2004, 2005. So when I found out that this was used on 9/11, I wasn't surprised. I wasn't surprised, but for most people, it's very difficult for them to take that in, because, you know, we're then...
So can I ask you something? So actually the hurricane came towards New York,
right?
Then all of a sudden looked at New York and says, oh, the towers have gone, too much distraction, so I'm going to move on.
Well,
go a different direction.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. It's almost as if you were to look at it from a sort of storytelling point of view. It really looks like that. This hurricane was saying, oh, what's going on in New York? I think there might be something happening on the 11th. I'll go and have a look. Oh, it's all right. It's happened now. I'll go off on my merry way. And it really does look like that. And you know, some people might want to write it off as a coincidence. I mean, I've written letters to people about this. We have this government Quango agency called Act on CO2. It's meant to be combating climate change nonsense. Mm-hmm. And I wrote to them and I pointed out the path of this hurricane, and they wrote back to me and said, oh, well, Mr. Johnson, it was hurricane season in September. And I said, no, you've forgotten the day. It was September the 11th that this was closest to New York, you know, when all those things happened. And they just wrote back to me and said, oh, I have nothing to add to your previous letter. In other words, this body, which is supposed to know about the climate or at least be able to refer me to somebody that does, had no answer for why this hurricane did what it did. And that's mm-hmm. because they can't answer the question, because in answering that question, they open up a whole new paradigm which they can't do anything about. And this is the big problem for people, because your consciousness will completely shift. You know, when you say that there's somebody out there that has the ability to steer hurricanes, I mean, what does that do to the notion of climate change? When you say that there's somebody out there with this technology which can turn two buildings to dust in 10 seconds each, what does that do to the arms race and all of this? You know, you're completely off the radar charts of where the sort of paradigm that most people are functioning in. So some mm-hmm. people are just, the only thing they can do is completely blank this out. They can't even take it in. It's just too hard. But, you know, from all I can tell you is that all the evidence, as far as I'm concerned, is now there. It's been put in place largely by Dr. Judy Wood since 2008. I've been looking at this, you know, since 2008, and the case, as I see it, has only got stronger to support that what we've said is true. And no one has really been able to explain all the evidence apart from using the explanation that Dr. Wood has used and I've used, and that is that free energy technology, which we could use to transform the planet, has been turned into a weapon by some group. We don't know who. We don't know who's got the weapon. We don't know where the weapon was. We can make certain guesses about how it works. We know that somebody has the technology to steer the hurricane and put it where they did. Did they create the hurricane from scratch? Don't know. But you go and look at that path, and you can pretty much see that it was steered there. So, you know,
maybe this 9/11, people, you know, who really want to delve into it, now really have to look for the weapon itself, which country has got it, and where it's hidden, and who's manufacturing it.
Well,
now we all know something happened, and the official story is not true.
Well, so I mean, well maybe what I would say is, if people want to follow that up, they should write to two companies. They should write to Science Applications International Corporation, and they should write to Applied Research Associates. I think one or both of those companies know a lot more than they're willing to tell. But, of course, they're defense companies, so they would just say, well, we can't talk to you because it's national security, you know, or something like that. So there's various people have spoken. I mean, for example, people talk about Tom Bearden, who's another researcher, and I always get calls, people calling and say, oh, have you listened to the research of Tom Bearden? Yes, I have listened to the research of Tom Bearden. And in fact, if you go and watch a video from 1985 by Tom Bearden, who was in the US military, he describes a technology in 1985 he gave at McDonnell Douglas, very like what we'd determined to seem to have been used. So, and there's a whole story to that.
And I wish you would come back in the next couple of weeks. And I thank you very much for coming to my show for the first time, and my show. You've been on so many other shows. After my show is now, will come Dr. Carly and also Arnie and the Medical Conspiracy after Dr. Carly. So I hope our listeners will stay in tune with Orion Network or Orion Talk Radio. I hope I said it right. Okay, thank you, Andrew, and thank you for my listeners. And have a great weekend. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.